Eat Drink Indie Radio is powered by eatdrinkindie.com. Eat local, drink local, eat drink indie. Welcome to Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. This week on Eat Drink Indie Radio, we're revisiting an interview from this past spring with Jason Werfel of Books and Brews. Back in April, when the interview originally aired, Books and Brews had just hit 3 years in business and had just signed on its first franchisee. And now the build-out on that Carmel franchise location is in progress, and a Brownsburg Books and Brews has just opened as well. It's always great to hear about a local business that's really connected with customers. And that's what Books and Brews has done. Customers sign up to join their mug club, they show up to play games, to participate in open mic nights, and of course, to drink beer. Some have even gotten to name one. So this week's show focuses on Books and Brews owner, Jason Werfel, who talks with us about starting a business, building a community, and how he ties it all in with his background in baseball. So stay with us for more here on Eat Drink Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. It's always great to see a local business take off, to see someone put an idea out there in the world, and then to see others find it and embrace it. And then we get to talk about it. So that's what we're doing today here on Eat Drink Indie Radio. We're spending our time today talking about beer and business and even baseball with Books and Brews owner Jason Werfel. Books and Brews just hit its 3-year anniversary. It now has 2 locations and more coming soon with franchising. So it seemed like a great time to talk about what's made the business work and how Jason and his customers have built a community around beer, books, games, music, and more.
I was an English major, and so it's hard for me to quantify exactly, you know, that pinpoint moment, because it was certainly a building process. So my wife and I are both English majors, and we had that dream of the quaint little used bookstore, the Paris and Company. Of course, like, sadly, that's a dead business model, basically, you know. It was obsolete, in fact. But really, I think the biggest along the years, you know, adding, I got into craft beer, I got into the local movement, you know, spend locally, support local businesses, and then later into home brewing, and all those things certainly accumulated, but into what we do here. You know, I was a writer, I was into music and the arts and stuff like that. And again, it all accumulated. But for me, I think the biggest thing was, one of the things I do well is observe. And one of the things, for example, that I always noticed was, attaching experience to a product always leads to a better, not just understanding, but appreciation of the product. Like, for example, if you listen to a song on the radio and then you see that band live, the next time you listen to that song on the radio, you're virtually guaranteed to like it more, because now you have an experience to attach to the product. And so when you're going into an industry like this, you know, knowing that and being a sales marketing type mind guy, it's hard for me to want not just put my bottle on a shelf in a liquor store or a supermarket, but it almost hurts me to do that, because I can't bottle an experience, you know. And I want people to experience the products that we have along with that. And so for me, it was all about experience from day one, and the rest of the stuff is commodities, but the experience is really our selling point. And so what is that? What is that experience, I guess, is the starting point. What do I want people to experience?
Well, how do you describe it? You know, how do you describe the experience that people get here?
Sure. I'll tell you what the aim is. So it's certainly, you know, the people could tell you exactly what they get out of it, but I can tell you where it came from me. And that was, The benefit of my business is that I'm basically the target demographic, and so it's easy for me to market towards myself. So when I was growing up, I was a jock. I played Division I baseball at University of Michigan, and so I was also highly recruited football player. But on the flip side of me, I was also a book nerd. I was a video game nerd. I always kind of felt like the man without a country type scenario. I was too nerdy to hang out with the jocks, too jockey to hang out with the nerds. And, I'm painting a very depressing, lonely picture of myself, and maybe that's more accurate than I would like to admit. But the point is that I never really felt like there was a place that spoke to me. I never felt like I had a place. And so the challenge is, how do you pull that off? And so that's what we started to try to figure out.
So you combine the whole idea of being an English major and the gaming and the books and the beer, yeah, and the local food focus sort of thing. Was it a hard pitch? Was it hard to pitch that concept to people? Did they get it?
No, they did not get it. No, at least I take it back. People did get it, but it really didn't hit me until we started our Kickstarter. So, obviously it's something you have in your brain, and you're like, books and beer and local and music and creative community and a relaxing place and a place where there's no TVs and you talk to people and the events are built around socially interacting, board games, and even like we do movie night is the most, I guess, technologically typed advanced thing we do, but that is but the movies we pick are in such a way that it's more Mystery Science Theater 3000 than it is, so we're picking movies that are still sort of enhancing that social experience. So
so it all came together somehow.
Yes, it did. It is weird. I call myself professionally ADD, and I've learned how to work with that along the way. But yeah, when I started to tell people about it, one of the things that one of my friends told me, for example, Jason, you can't be all things to all people. And my response to him was, I'm not trying to. I'm just trying to be something to somebody. And I think that, and I say this all the time, but Books and Brews is kind of, I pictured as my performance art piece for the startup entrepreneur and also for that person who never had a place. Like I'm literally, and again, this sounds like super depressing. I know, but like I'm literally trying to build my own place where I can go and feel comfortable and accepted and appreciated. And like any good, and I've said this to a couple of people, like any good artist, whether you're an artist or a writer or a musician, if you're creating anything, and I throw business in there too, you only really want two things in my mind. You want people to experience it. You want people to see it, read it, hear it, and then you want people to get it. And so those are really your only hopes. And the getting it part can be individualistic too. It can be something, for us, people who don't care about beer might see this place as a place to come and they have a Coke and they play board games with their friends. Or some people who are really into beer and into nothing else we do, they come here every Friday because we do a new beer every Friday, and they're a hobbyist that wants to try a lot of, different craft beers. So it speaks to people in different ways. But yeah, I think when it really hit me in terms of like, wow, people actually get it, is we started the Kickstarter. And
now, when did you start that?
We started it, so I signed the lease for here, our first location, in November of 2013. So I want to say I started it at the end of that summer, about. It was 45 days maybe, and so yeah, I wrapped up sometime in October, I want to say, of 2013. And we started, immediately, first of all, Kickstarter emailed me and said, wow, great concept. We're going to feature you on our staff picks. And I was like, well, that's amazing. And then we started getting, to this day, people that I've never met that backed the project for $250, $500. We have a couple that lives in Illinois that visits once a year, and it's always very emotional. Because the whole, what blows me away, and this is why, like, to my dying breath, I will say Kickstarter is the greatest thing on the planet, is that it does, you get to skip the elevator pitch to the suits who control the money and try to give them, like, okay, it's a bunch of people who are geeky about a lot of different things, and then that would be it. That's all you'd get. I guarantee, like, wouldn't get it. And I didn't even get to that point. I just went to Kickstarter, and that's what's great. You get to skip that. You get to go right to the public and say, are you interested? Is this something are you in? And when you have people from states away that still to the, like, 3 years later, I've never met these people, and gave me $250. And
that's pretty awesome, right there.
Yes, it is. It is. It's beyond awesome. It's like emotional on a level you almost can't even. Especially with, again, everything I've said, like I'm almost on the verge of tears whenever I talk about this, but like, people that just see an idea and say, I want to financially support that with no sense of getting anything out of it is something that's so humbling. I can barely get the words out without breaking into tears. And I'm pretty emotional anyway. So it's nothing new, but, it blew me away. It absolutely blew me away. So we raised about 17 grand and, I was lucky enough that, I worked in the baseball industry and we had some successful years. So I had some money saved up from that, but it was just me all myself going at it. And, bless my wife, she is not a entrepreneurial spirit. So she was a nervous wreck. And I think everyone that I knew was, I think people around you get, typical worries of starting businesses. Everyone, they're worried about it failing. They're worried about the bar industry and some of the stereotypical problems that come with that. But part of what we do here doesn't align to some of that anyway. We very rarely get people that overindulge. We very rarely have those problems that I think are typical in some other places. I mean, we have people that come in here and that's what they're looking for. They're just looking for a place to get away from Facebook for 5 minutes and actually speak to someone. And that is why I see the longevity and the importance of something like this, is because we're not going backwards, right? We're not going anti-technology anytime soon. So even myself, as guilty of this as anybody, and that is, I haven't ordered a pizza over the phone for probably 15 years. And if you would have told
all me, online, right?
Yeah, everything's online. So pizza's online, you order sandwiches online, it shows up at your door, never have to talk to anybody. And because of that, people, there is something to that. Like you can add the technology, but I don't think you're ever going to take away the basic human need to connect to people, to want to be a part of something. I think that these are our founding philosophies and principles that people do have a built-in need to, like, we're tribal by nature, right? We have a built-in need to belong, a built-in need to be accepted and appreciated, and feeling like that we don't have to change who we are to do those things, that people can accept, appreciate, and encourage us as we are. And then, of course, the difficult part is figuring out how to accomplish that.
We've been talking with Books and Brews owner Jason Werfel. Stay with us for more from Jason here on WFYI and WFYI.org. For Books and Brews owner Jason Werfel, brewing beer is more about the art than the science, and the business is all about connecting with people. So whether it's through beer or games or art or music, Books and Brews is all about making those connections. One way they did that early on was through naming the beers, like Nancy Brew and the Hoppy Boys, or Clifford the Big Red Ale. So tell me a little bit about your background in brewing and how the beers came about, and of course how you name them.
Oh, sure. So the last question first. So everything here is literary in nature. So what's great too is that, I mean, part of what we do to try to build the community is make sure both our employees and our customers feel like they're a part of it. And with that, we use them to help us name the beers. But yeah, literary puns mainly, characters, themes.
Give me some examples.
Yes, yeah, so specific books. So our flagship-y beers are, I say flagship-y because we don't really have anything that's, we will in the future, pretty soon here, hopefully have standard house beers that'll be on all the time. But so, for example, Nancy Brew and the Hoppy Boys, Clifford the Big Red Ale, Charlie and the Chocolate Stout, Cream and Punishment, and Shogun Soba Ale is kind of a stretch, but so we go on and on from there. Blonde with the Wind.
Those are great. Yeah. So your customers like that. They get the puns and they enjoy it, right?
Yeah, well, it's part of the nostalgia factor. So for example, I mean, even we had someone just the other day come in and say, I don't even drink blondes, but I have to have Blonde with the Wind because I love that book. It's my favorite book. And that is, I mean, it's It's great from a in a vacuum marketing strategy. It makes me feel good as like a, you know, sales marketing guy to be like, yes, the marketing's working, but it's also cool from a nostalgic perspective. It goes back to the whole idea of connecting experience with the product and the desire to connect to people on a level more than just like I am drinking a beer. And I think that when you can do that, and that's why I think the longevity of the model, it revolves around that nostalgia factor that people feel. For example, when we do a Game of Thrones themed or Song of Ice and Fire, so Sours of Ice and Fire, we did a series of four bottles and people come in and buy them. They don't taste them, they just buy them. I gotta have them. I love the books, I love the show, I gotta have the beer too. So yeah, that's that. I think that is that's how the names come about. Now, in terms of my own background, I am, and this will probably make a lot of people quiver. Like I'm a business guy. Like what I love is business. I love people, and the main focus of my business was just like I said, it was all about the experience and the people. Now the beer was a part of that, a part of the I lump the brewing industry, especially nowadays, into the creative community with artists and writers and musicians. I think it's along that same line. Gamers, there's a lot of artistry. I think, and that's my angle. I see beer as more of an art than a science, and there's a lot of people that would disagree with me on that. You know what I mean? But that's fine. To each their own. Beer, especially nowadays, is really driven science heavy. For me, it is an art, and it's fun and creative. And so I'm really just some hack home brewer who started home brewing and had a lot of fun with the beer and thought the beer tasted good. And I'm a business guy. And so when I open Books and Brews, I think that that's a strength of mine, that I'm not so traditional. And as a baseball guy, I know this, that, you know, baseball, for example, is a industry steeply rooted in tradition, to where the point where it really affects their ability to evolve because of that. And
because we want it to be the way it is, right?
And I think that that's probably a strength of mine, that I'm not deeply rooted in the tradition of the brewing industry. Like, I appreciate it, right? But it's not like I'm going to,
You're not going to say it's always been done this way, so this is how we have to do it.
Right. Yeah. Like I said, more of an art than a science. So I have fun with it, and it gives me, I think it gives me the leeway to where I'm not so much like I'm this champion brewer that, that makes it sound like I was knocking that, you know, but like I'm not going to take advice, or someone says, hey, I want an orange wheat, and I'm going to chase them out because you shouldn't like orange wheats. You should like imperial stouts, you know, like I'm going to brew it. People want, and I'm going to brew crazy stuff that are going to push the boundaries and do it in kind of a fun, creative, unapologetic way. And I think our crowd appreciates that. And also appreciates the risk taking. Like there's going to be duds. Like when you do stuff like that, like that's what's going to happen. And I think that, as a failed writer myself, some of the best advice I ever got is don't be afraid to write badly. And that is, I think that's great advice in all facets of life, that what stops us in this paralysis by analysis moment is that we're just afraid of what we do being crap. So
you're exactly right on that.
Yeah. So, we want every word that comes out of our mouth to be able to be published, you know, and a lot of times when we just allow ourselves the creative freedom to be terrible at what we're doing, we get to the end and realize it was actually pretty solid. And not only that, but we actually have something instead of just staring and doing nothing all the time, you know?
And nothing really terrible happened if it wasn't great, right?
Exactly. And it is also, I think it's a freeing concept on a personal level, but it's also, I think, freeing concept from a customer standpoint, an employee standpoint that says, hey, we're going to take risks. And if you have ideas, we're going to do them. And we're going to see what happens. If it's a good one, we'll keep doing it. If it's a bad one, we won't ever do it again. But like...
Now, you do let customers have that input, right?
Yeah. So we've since discontinued it only because we had too many names to work with. But we used to do... for trivia, you could get a $20 gift card, or you could name a beer.
Did everyone want to name the beers?
Yeah, everyone wanted to name beers. We had hundreds of beer names. So, but it worked out awesome. Like, even so, a lot of the beers that became regular beers were all trivia winners. So, Nancy Brew and the Hoppy Boys was a beer that was named by one of the librarians from Fisher's. And I could go on and on. I mean, a lot of the beers were trivia names. So that's, I mean, one of my best examples is we're right by Home Depot here in our original location, and someone who works at Home Depot would walk over for lunch occasionally, and I used that example. He was like, "You should have an orange wheat called a Clockwork Orange." I was like, "That's a great idea." And I brewed it the next day, and 2 weeks later, when he came to have lunch, he looked at the board and he was like, "Hey, you got a beer called Clockwork Orange?" I'm like, "Yeah, I took your idea and I did it. Isn't that cool?" And he's like, "That's amazing," and you have that. And when you're able to connect with your audience in that level, you've now invested them on a level higher than they can get anywhere else. Because now, and again, like I said, like I separate myself, like in a sales marketing vacuum, I'm able to go like, good job, you know, like 5 gold stars, like you know, those people are going to go out and tell their friends, and they're going to bring their friends in. Like, hey, look, I named a beer. And, you know, that's what happened with trivia. With trivia winners, like, your beer's coming out in April, whatever, whatever. And they would bring all their friends in to try the beer they named. And so it worked out from a sales marketing perspective. But on a totally different level, it was a connection with the customer that is something irreplaceable. I mean, you cannot measure. I'm not even sure the word for, I don't know, goodwill is not really the strong enough word. Like, you can't measure the ownership that having someone care about something that much, that for the rest of their life, they'll have a story that they named a beer in a brewery. And
how cool is that?
It's extremely cool. It's the best thing ever. I think it's the number one mistake that a lot of people that get into business have, is that they have this very tight to the vest, I'm in control and everything goes through me, and it has to be my idea, it has to be what I originally intended it, and they fail to evolve and they fail to connect and they fail to provide that ownership level to the customer base. And, you know, a lesson that I learned very early in business is that there's only one boss, and that's the customer, and they can fire all of us at any time they want simply by not coming. And so we have to know, I didn't come up with that, but I wish I did, but we have to understand that every day and make sure we're not only just, it's not just about customer service. It's about customer connection. It's about making sure that we're providing something at another level that they can't get anywhere else. And so how do we challenge ourselves to do that with everything we do to bring people in, you know, whether it's, you know, for example, I play in a little silly ukulele band, and we just play cover 90s cover songs. And we put out a second mic and bring people up from the audience to come sing along. Everyone knows the words. There's all these silly 90s songs. And again, you're doing something that is different. You're doing something that probably normal artists wouldn't do, like share the spotlight. You're doing something that is a memory that people will hold on to and people will tell. And now you've developed that emotional response and connection to a product and a place. And, yeah, and trying to find a way to do that in every single, that's our challenge, trying to do that in every single thing we do.
We're talking today with Jason Werfel of Books and Brews in Indianapolis and Zionsville. Stay with us for more from Jason on beer, business, and growing a community. And look for more info on Books and Brews at booksandbrews.com. We are back here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio, and we're talking today with local entrepreneur Jason Werfel of Books and Brews, which just hit its third year in business. Jason tells us how the book aspect fits into the business plan, how that business model has changed, and how the books provide a perk for members of the Books and Brews Mug Club. Tell me a little bit about the books part of it, because you mentioned early on, you know, the idea of how it would be cool to have a little bookstore and that kind of stuff. So how did that part of it evolve into what you have now?
Sure. So Okay, this is a good example of my main advice for anyone who wants to start a business is that you can jot a business plan all you want, but just know that you need to rip that thing up as soon as you open the doors, and you need to allow your customers to, just like I said before, you have to evolve, you have to, you know, mold yourself to your customer. Your business plan will draw the customers, but then now the customers are in charge. So what I mean by that is when I'm business planning this place, my idea was it's basically thirds. We are a third brewery, restaurant, if you will. We're a third bookstore. We're a third event space. All of that together, hopefully, will play off each other and be successful business. But when you open up, you realize you are 99% event space. And certainly, like, you sell beer and you make money off of it. But, like, that's really what it's all about, is you're about the experience. So what I mean is when we first started, we were thinking, you know, we're going to have a lot more book-heavy events, materials, but we don't. We ended up just going, we were used books to begin with, but we wanted to have kind of a buy sell trade. That was part of our business plan. We start to realize that people are cleaning out their attics and then never buying any books because they just want the store credit for beer.
So they're bringing books and not taking away books.
Yes. So we're overflowing with books and we're running out of beer. And so we realized that's probably not a good idea. So we basically just, and again, the number one rule in business is follow the money. So, but with that being said, the books are so important here that, first of all, they're just donated by customers. And the whole idea here is community. And community is Mug Club membership, number one. And I know I'm jumping around, but like the idea is, how do we make our Mug Club membership worth it the most? And then what are we going to do with these books? So,
well, first, tell me what the Mug Club is.
Okay, sure. Yeah. So our Mug Club is a one-time, so we just bumped it up a little bit, $70 for life. So you can't get out even if you want out. So that's our sales pitch. And so my thought process is always, how do I make it more worth it? One of my biggest complaints as a guy who is pretty observant sales marketing wise is that a lot of programming out there, sales marketing, is designed to pull in new customers and not satisfy the current customers. And I always, and again, like, I'm not trying to, like, I am a subscriber to Sports Illustrated, so I don't mean to bag on them, but like, everything Sports Illustrated has is designed to get the new customer. It is, you get a free polo, but only if you've never bought from us before. If you've been buying us for 20 years, you don't get a polo, you get the next edition. That's it. That's all you get, and be happy about it. And so, and maybe they've changed that. I don't know. I guess I don't subscribe anymore. So anyway, that's my idea is, like, yes, we all want to spend money to get new customers, but I need to figure out, how do I make sure every day our regulars and our Mug Club members feel even more satisfied, even more, more connected to what they're doing here and wanting to share that experience with other people. So, that being said, another thing that I think, again, everything that we do trying to build upon this personal connection. So we get all of our mugs handmade by a potter here in Indiana. So we are now, between the two locations, over almost 1,400 Mug Club members.
Wow. So that's a lot. Yeah, I mean, that seems like an awful lot.
Especially a lot if you're the one making the mugs, which I don't have to, which is great. I don't want to be in that business. But what's great is Josh Heim is his name. It's Josh Heim Pottery. Definitely check it out. Don't give him too much business or he won't be able to make mugs for me. This is the great thing about Books and Brews. Like, he's now in the process of growing. He's adding staff members, whereas so through Books and Brews and our business, we've been able to help other businesses grow, which I think is fantastic. And so Josh has handmade every single mug for us every time. And so what we do is we've kind of made it into a collector's item sort of thing. So we had year one mugs that were kind of like a stein, and year two sort of had a bell shape. Year three was a pint glass shape. And this year kind of has more of a, I don't know what you would call it. It's kind of like, you know, it's wider at the bottom than it is at the top, with a handle again. So we wouldn't wait. The point is that we have different ones every year, and Josh does. So you have literally this piece of art that everyone, so you sign up for the club, you get a handmade mug by Josh to take home with you. And the marketing angle for us is that it's sitting on your shelf every day. And if you're going to decide to go out, you are reminded that you get better deals at Books and Brews, right? Plus it makes a great coffee mug. And like, a lot of people use them for coffee every day. So it's just, it's a constant, you get a good use out of it, but it's also constant marketing.
So people will sign up, pay their money, and they get a mug, right?
Yep. They get a mug, take home, and a membership card. And so every time they come in, they don't have to bring their own mug. We have house mugs. And so you get the mug fill for the same price as a pint, which is, again, they're handmade. So like sometimes it'll vary, right? But it's like we say 4 to 6 extra ounces of every pour forever for life. And so all the perks are for life, right? It's a lifetime membership. So you get $2 off growler fills, $1 off bullet fills. We do right now, which is probably an unsustainable program for our franchisees, but between our two current stores, we do free barbecue every single month at both stores for our Mug Club members from local barbecue. So it's usually like pulled pork, baked beans, mac and cheese, stuff like that. Totally free. And on and on, 10% off merchandise. And again, and with the books, because the books is what got me started on this. And it's so Mug Club members have free lifetime book exchange. So we're almost like a library, you know, forever for Mug Club members. So they can leave a book, take a book. So we started to do book exchanges, and we were like, why don't we just make that a Mug Club perk? That's a good perk to have, especially for – so part of this is I was a stay-at-home dad for 2 years in the meantime, and I always say I didn't want to work so hard, so I got into business. And
exactly.
Yeah, it's rough, man, let me tell you. There's no commute. You don't get to take a lunch break. You can't even take a shower. I could go on and on. Okay, so it was really important to me to have family space, because you realize there's not really like a lot of cool places to take your kids. Yeah, and for everybody. So Children's Museum's a cool place, don't get me wrong. Fantastic. Indianapolis got one of the best on the planet. Zoo's great, but
but for a day-to-day kind of thing.
Yeah, if you're going to go, you can't go every single day, right? And occasionally having a beer helps as a parent. Let's just be honest. So being able to do that and then the key, again, from the vacuum sales marketing is to get to the point where the kids are now asking for, can we go to Books and Brews? And the parents go, heck yeah, we can. And so that's the idea. And so
so you have a family space out front, a very kid-friendly space.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, we're very kid-friendly. And we get that a lot. I think that's kind of our age of us too, is that the stigma of like taking the kid to the bar has kind of died out. Like it's not really a thing anymore. I'm from Michigan where you can just, you know, you go there and people just have the baby sitting on the bar, you know what I mean? But even in Indiana, like it's not, you know, 30 somethings, 40 somethings, because craft beer now is more of a hobby. Right, it's more hobbyist, and whereas you know back in the day, I think there was a little bit more of a stigma on the bar scene where you're just going to go and you know pound 12 beers and you know what I mean. So that's not an environment for kids, obviously. So with that being said, so you combine the books and parents. So anyway, the book exchange is what I was talking about. So the idea that being able to come in and leave some kids' books and take some brand new kids' books was appealing to me. You know, and again, like I said, this all stems from my own vanity that I just want a place for myself to go. But yeah, so that's how the books came around. So now our books are 100% donated by our customers, and we just sell them for $3. So you can buy them permanently for $3, or if you're in the Mug Club, you can just take them and leave them.
We're talking today with Jason Werfel of Books and Brews, which has two locations in Indianapolis and Zionsville. Stay with us for more as Jason explains how his background in baseball has influenced the business here on WFYI and WFYI.org. I'm Jolene Ketzenberger, and we're talking today here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio with Jason Werfel of Books and Brews, a local brewery focused as much on creating a community as it is on brewing beer. Books and Brews recently hit 3 years in business, and it seemed like a great time to catch up, especially since it's baseball season, because Jason admits to using baseball as a business metaphor a lot, even though you won't be watching a game at Books and Brews because there are no TVs. You mentioned earlier some baseball references. So tell me a little bit about that part of your background and how that has kind of influenced where you are business-wise.
Sure. Yeah. Baseball has, you know, 100% to do with all of my daily decisions. My staff's running joke is that it's like the baseball drinking game. So every time Jason mentions baseball, everyone take a drink, which is a lot. So and again, you know, to jockey for the nerds, I guess. Yeah. but So I grew up and I was a jock, and football, baseball, actually more heavily recruited for football. But again, being the nerd that I was on the other angle, I was a punter and a place kicker, which is a bummer because Indianapolis is the best place to be a punter. It's like the only city on earth, I feel like, where the punter's a celebrity, which is amazing. anyway, so I chose baseball because football's like I think place kicker is probably like the worst position in all of professional sports, because all you do is get like crapped on by every announcer and every teammate, and then you go in the game and miss the field goal, and then everyone hates you. So decided.
So it was baseball.
So it was baseball. So anyway, long story short, so I played baseball, and in the meantime, that was around really the 90s is when baseball started to figure out people don't care as much about baseball. So how do we get people to the park? And their answer was to sort of run a sales marketing campaign that transforms the ballpark into something that's not baseball. So people are now thinking of the ballpark as a social experience, whereas the baseball game is barely part of that. And the outcome is something for everybody. The kids get to run, they get to play. My daughter just goes and hits the mister 1,000 times in a row and gets drenched.
So I'm seeing Victory Field is what I'm thinking here, right? So this minor league baseball team here, you know, in Indianapolis is a perfect example of what you're talking about.
Yeah, exactly. This is an example. We were chatting before this that I guarantee you could walk up to a random person on the street and say, "Do you like baseball?" And the odds are they're going to say no. And then if you ask them, "Have you been to an Indians game?" The odds are they're going to say yes. And the reason for that is because of this trick that minor league baseball has pulled off, where baseball is not a part of it. And now you have this experience that people are focused not on each other, but on sort of their experience. So, you know, you get to socialize, you get to eat food, you get to drink beer, the kids get to run, you have you have this all encompassing experience. And then maybe once in a while, someone hits it over the fence and you cheer, and you don't even know if it's the home team or not. And, I always say, not always say, but statistically, the exit surveys will show you that people don't know who played. They don't even know, the average person probably doesn't even know that the Indians are a Pirates affiliate, for example.
They don't know the names of the players, that sort of thing.
They don't know any of that stuff. But they know the bathroom was clean. They know if the food was good, if the beer was warm. They know these are the things that they really – did they have fun? You know, what kind of experience they had? So anyway, the point is that the trick that baseball pulled off is that – they gave a great experience to people that do not care at all about baseball. So then taking that into the business world, the challenge is, okay, you have your commodities in your business, right? So how do you still continue to get into demographics that don't care about beer, that don't care about music, that don't care about grilled cheese sandwiches, that don't care about, how do you get those people to come in? And, finding ways to do that. Minor league baseball is my model for that. And one of the other examples I use is I always talk about like fancy steak places versus dive bars. So you go in a fancy steakhouse and you're wearing dirty sweatpants and a tank top. Like, you're going to feel uncomfortable. And if you walk into a dive bar with a $3,000 suit on, you're going to feel uncomfortable.
You certainly will stand out.
Yes, you'll certainly stand out. People will notice. And to the point where some people, you might actually force the manager to ask you to leave, and the reason for that is because in those places, the people are part of the atmosphere all the way to their attire. Their actual attire is part of their product. It was part of what they're selling, is that people dress up here, or people, even the dive bar, people are here. And that is, part of their appearance is
part of the appeal.
Yeah, part of the appeal. So with that being said, you take all those people and you put them in a ballpark. You have a family of five. You have someone in suit. You have, white collar next to blue collar next to – no one even notices. No one cares. And the reason is because you've created something where their clothing is not part of the experience. It's not part of the atmosphere. This is something so – so bigger, so much bigger than that. It's all about the experience. And so the challenge is, like I said, how do you take that into a business? And I think the solution is to focus on people's on outside of each other. You know, so you're focusing people on the books, you're focusing people on the music, focusing people on the conversation, on the beer, on the food. People don't even notice each other. And for example, like taking away the TVs is one example of that.
Well, now explain that, because there aren't any TVs here.
Yeah, so that goes back to me saying, for example, I haven't ordered pizza online for 15 years. So the idea is, and I think a lot of people that are my age or older would agree, that you had an era where you felt like you were disconnected to, like, for example, a class reunion, right? Class reunions are like almost obsolete nowadays because of Facebook and Twitter and whatever else. But at the same token, you almost feel more distant now than you did then. Like, you're actually forced to call each other back then and talk to each other. And now you don't even have to do that. Like, you know, and so there's not a lot of incentive to keep in touch when you can just log on Facebook and see what's happening. And so there's people, I guarantee, in your Facebook feed right now that are what you would consider relatively decent friends of yours. You haven't even spoken to in 5, 6, 7, 8 years. And how weird is that? That's super weird. And I think that people will never lose that. And I think that creates something inside of us that we, I think, need, without even realizing it, need to exercise. Like, and that's why I think we go to dinner. What happens is we go to dinner in order to connect to somebody, and then we end up watching TV the whole time. And we never actually accomplish that. That's why, like, for example, like, I love movies. I'm a movie buff. But like, if I want to have a social time, like, you're not going to go to the movie theater. Like, hey, let's hang out and go to the movie theater. It's not hanging out.
No, because you can't talk to them. That's not a talking sort of get together at all.
Yeah. It's, hey, how you doing before the movie? And like, well, see you later afterwards. And it's, you know, that's like the in-person version of Facebook, I guess, you know what I mean? Like, the only thing we know about each other is we sat next to each other for 2 hours and then left. So with that, and I think the fact that our model encourages that, all of our events encourage that, everything we do here, everything that we train our staff to say, and the way we set up our space, and is all designed to do that. Get people out of their seat, get people engaged, get people talking to each other. And first of all, it draws people that are naturally wanting that are desperate for that are looking for someone to connect to, a place to go, to be accepted, appreciated. And so that when you start to have a critical mass of people like that, and then you kind of nudge that along with the social events, and you nudge that along with the way the space is set up, you have strangers engaging each other everywhere. You have gamers, you know, a person posted online the other day, it's like, could have been the best ad for us ever, is at Books and Brews playing games with a bunch of strangers. You know what I mean? Like, that is us. That's so Books and Brews. You just come here.
That's pretty cool. So that actually happened.
Yeah, no, that's a true story. Yeah, that happens. It happens. I mean, literally every time I feel like I come in and I'm talking to regulars of ours, it eventually always seems to turn around that even as regulars, you're still sort of amazed that you come in and engage with complete strangers. I mean, certainly that happens occasionally at places, but like, when's the last time that you went to a restaurant and were seated at a table and engaged in a 30-minute conversation with a complete total stranger? I mean, it just doesn't happen very often. And so we try to provide that, you know, that atmosphere. So the atmosphere draws the people that are seeking it. And then what happens is it almost becomes then impossible to be anonymous. You know, it really does. Like, we don't have the dark. Certainly, if you want to come here and you really don't want to talk to anybody, you can accomplish that if you really try. But usually what you have is, as soon as someone says, this is my first time here, you have 6 heads that turn. And now you have all these Mug Club members that are virtually extensions of the staff. And this is not an exaggeration, that you don't even this by the time my staff gets to that person, they know everything about the place.
Someone has already told them, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So it's or they've told them beforehand. Like I was saying before we started recording, that we get this like Sherpa-like experience where I'll be in the office and I'll hear, and here's where they do movies, and here's where they have their bourbon barrel aging room, and here's where they're, and I think it's my staff, and I walk out and it's not. It's just someone who I don't even know has brought in more people that I don't know, and they're explaining the business model. And I think that again, it goes back to all you really want is for people to experience it, and then you want people to get it. And I think that is getting it on a level that is something that I almost couldn't even have made up in a story, that people would care about the place so much and so fast that they want to physically drag people here to share it with them.
We've been talking with Jason Werfel of Books and Brews in Indianapolis and Zionsville. Stay with us as Jason tells us how the business is growing here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI and WFYI.org. We are back here on Eat, Drink, Indie Radio, and we're talking today with Jason Werfel of Books and Brews. With locations in Indianapolis and Zionsville, Books and Brews combines the idea of a used bookstore with a brewery and an event space, and it creates community along the way. And it's a concept that seems poised to expand in a big way. Jason tells us that while it wasn't easy in the beginning, Books and Brews is ready to franchise. So tell me where it's growing from here. You know, what's, you know, how is it going to grow next?
Sure. So really, when we started Zionsville is where it really took off, because I think from one of the biggest hurdles in opening a business that I was kind of naive about, because in my upbringing, hotels in the ballpark, like, we own the land, or, you know, the hotel was existing. So you never really deal with landlords that much, you know, in those industries that I was from. So the idea of a landlord saying, no, we don't want you, blew me away. Like, I totally thought I would go into business, I would have money, and I would go to a landlord and go, hey, I have money, you have an open space, let's do business. And when I was a startup company, I got turned down at least 6 or 7 times before I found a space that would lease to me.
They just didn't want the business there, or didn't think it was a business that would be successful, or what?
Yeah, all of the above. I think that landlords in general are leery of A, startups, and then B, startups that will, because they think they're going to go out of business, because most businesses do, right? I mean, that's just statistics. And then, so number two is startups that are going to come in and do heavy alterations to the space and then go out of business. And that's breweries, right? You got to dig out trenches for drainage. You got to put in a lot of electrical, a lot of lighting, a lot of, you know, gas lines, depending on what kind of system you're running. And so that's scary for a landlord, because if you go out of business, now they have this weird hodgepodge space that they can't rent
somebody else. Right.
So when we opened Zionsville, I think that everyone's eyes opened that, wow, this was a business that we opened in 2 months. So we opened super fast. That can go into an ex-restaurant space really easy. So you have, so open fast, really easy to operate, you know, does well, draws quickly, has a name now, unlike a startup business. Like, we sold 50, 60 Mug Club memberships in Zionsville before we even opened the door.
Wow. So there's awareness there already.
Yeah. I mean, I think you have a very niche appeal, and I think that everywhere you have people that are like, man, I would sign up if there's one closer to me. So I think that what we'll see is, and part of our model is, no matter how many stores we open, our Mug Club membership will always be transferable.
Oh, now that's kind of neat.
Yeah. The idea is, and again, this is a baseball concept, is that people during the summertime go on ballpark tours. They don't go on baseball game tours. They go on ballpark tours. And the reason is because every ballpark, you understand what's going to happen when you walk through the gates, but every ballpark's different. And there's going to be some sort of personal fingerprint. And my example is always Fenway. So for the non-baseball people, it's the baseball field with the big green wall. So when people go to Fenway, they take pictures of the big green wall. They stand by the big green wall. Everything is the big green wall and what happens around the big green wall. But that's the idea, is that it's a tourist attraction. It's not about the baseball game. No one cares. No one cares. Except for, I mean, there are obviously diehards, and major league level even more so.
It's the experience.
Right. It's the experience. And so the idea is to almost create a network of Books and Brews that becomes a Books and Brews passport tour, Mug Club. Now, I land in D.C. and there's a Books and Brews there. I wonder what this Books and Brews is like. Maybe it has a big green wall, you know? Maybe there's a menu item or a beer or something weird going on there that's just a little bit different from everywhere else. So it's an experience that is predictable, but on a whole, but at the same time customized. And it doesn't just tell the Books and Brews story. It tells the franchisee story. So that's where I'm going with that.
Franchising.
Yeah, where, again, when we opened Zionsville, we started getting tons of interest from landlords going, yeah, come into our space.
Now they're asking.
Yeah, now they now they're interested. Well, it makes sense, you know. I get it, but yeah, that's how you feel. Like, where were you guys 3 years ago, right? But and the big thing is when you're talking tap room versus brewery, that you're much less intrusive. That a lot of landlords have second generation restaurant spaces that you don't have to do a lot of modifications of, but the biggest thing, the biggest kicker is that we just, and I think the word is out, right? We have 13,000 fans on Facebook and 4,000 or 5,000 on Twitter, and our Zionsville store by themselves has 4,000 or 5,000 Facebook fans, and people follow us. People dig what we do, and it draws people distances. We have people from Avon that skip past Zionsville and come here for open mic night. So
you're going to be able to recreate that for other people? Yes. Help other people create their own sort of thing.
Right, exactly. I think that's the point. I think that being able to go into different communities and like I said, tell our story, but also let the customers take hold of their individualistic books and brews and take that maybe in a way that we're not even anticipating right now. And doing it the taproom way. So the concept that we're going forward with is we do have beer, and that's part of what we do. So what we're going to do is we're going to license our beers to a brewery, regional breweries, because the idea is hopefully go to other states, right? So license our beer and have flagship beers and put the beers in cans and then have those available at our taprooms. And in Indiana, at least, you can sell beer to go. So even though you wouldn't be able to do growlers, you can sell six packs to go and have those flagship beers. So you help the brewery by brewing more beer. They help us by being able to sell franchises because the franchisees want our beer on draft. And, of course, we're just a teeny tiny brewery. There's no way we'd ever be able to do it. And it saves us because we don't have to invest in some million-dollar production facility somewhere. So it helps all of us grow faster, which is the dream, right? I mean, it helps out a whole bunch of different people in that regard.
We've been talking today with Jason Werfel of Books and Brews in Indianapolis and Zionsville, and it will soon have a franchise location in Carmel as well. For more information, check out booksandbrews.com. I'm Jolene Katzenberger, and you've been listening to Eat, Drink, Indie Radio on WFYI HD2 The Point. Thank you so much for tuning into our show this week and listening in as we spend our time today talking about beer, books, business, and baseball. And thanks also to our guest, Jason Werfel, owner of Books and Brews in Indianapolis and Zionsville. And thanks also to producer John Katzenberger for helping to bring you Eat, Drink, Indie Radio. Eat, Drink, Indie Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndie.com. Eat local, drink local, eat, drink, indie.